Welcome to another edition of Mormon Land. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, and I oversee our faith coverage. I'm joined again by our senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hello, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
From its earliest days, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has emphasized community. But the global faith of 16 million may be shifting away somewhat from that approach. Sunday services have been trimmed from 3 hours to two, with a new emphasis on home-centered gospel study. Scouting is on the way out, replaced by a more individualized program for young children and teens. By most accounts, members are excited about and eager for these new directions. But is something being lost in the process? Here to discuss the issue is Matthew Bowman, head of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Matt, to sort of set up some historical precedent, could you describe some of Mormonism's sort of community efforts in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Yeah, that is a big question, but I'll give it a shot.
It is.
Whole books have been written about it, but...
Several. So it's a really common motif among historians of Mormonism to emphasize that 19th century Mormons really conceived of their world as being an intensely communal one. They believed, as members of the church do today, that salvation was a collective effort. And this may be, I think, the biggest difference from the 19th and 20th century. Like a lot of other new religious movements in the 19th century, 19th century Mormons translated that theological and spiritual belief about kind of spiritual relationships into the secular world as well, or what we might call the secular world. They organized a separatist society, which they believed was distinct from the society that surrounded them in the United States. And so that meant that the church was doing a lot of stuff other than simply healing practices and teaching about the spiritual unity of the faithful. There were, of course, economically communal efforts of the law of consecration under Joseph Smith, and then a bunch of different other sorts of efforts under Brigham Young that followed that, in which the saints pooled their economic resources. And then, of course, the church was doing a lot of things that we would today call secular. Beginning in the 1860s, the Relief Society began organizing medical training and eventually founded hospitals. The church sponsored various artistic efforts as well, and many, many things like that. And a lot of these things reached into the 20th century. Some of them, though, have increasingly been eliminated. And that, I think, is what you are getting at in your introduction, that some of the social efforts the church had once mounted is increasingly abandoning. Whether that means a retreat from communalism is another question entirely, though.
Back in the 19th century, I didn't want to mention that early Latter-day Saints were sort of, as you said, separatists. They were called out of whatever community they lived in or whatever family structure into forming a new kind of family of believers, right?
Yes.
But also, I mean, I hate to bring this up, but polygamy also meant that people were not living, families were not living with nuclear little families. They were pretty big extended families, and that seemed all part of the same kind of community way of raising kids, the way of doing economics, the way of managing farms. Am I wrong about that?
No, you know, and this is, I think, a precise example of the ways in which what we would consider the borders between the sacred and the secular really blurred for these saints, right? The things that they believed in shaped the ways that they lived in ways that made them very, very distinct from the society around them. Polygamy, of course, I think is a preeminent example of that sense of building a new massive church family distinct from the outside world.
So then let's move into the 20th century, like you said, and starting the 1860s, the Women's Relief Society had these projects. And what about the mid-20th century, the 50s and 60s? What kinds of things emerged then to build on that same theology, but now they've given up polygamy, and so they're now part of the society, primarily American society, but there's still this push to be separate in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. Although I think what's interesting, right, is a lot of the social efforts the church begins mounting in the late 19th and early 20th century actually mirror things that other religious groups are doing. So it's less, I think, that the saints at this point are perceived as deviant. Rather, they're engaging in the same kind of intensely social efforts that many religions are at this point. So among these are, for instance, music. Of course, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir acquires that name in the mid-1920s as it begins radio broadcasts. The church begins in the early 20th century to launch a series of sports leagues. The most famous is basketball, because chapels still have basketball courts, but there were also volleyball and softball leagues and tournaments that the church was sponsoring. But this is something that other religions were doing as well, particularly Roman Catholics, right? There were similar Roman Catholic tournaments. Road shows begin in the early 20th century as well, in the 1920s, but these are building off of, you know, this long kind of tradition of theatricality among the saints, going really back to Nauvoo and to the Trek West when Brigham Young was organizing theatrical performances there as well. And then you brought up, right, you brought up the efforts of the Relief Society, who were in the 1860s organizing medical efforts. By the late 19th, early 20th century, was really operating first Deseret Hospital, which was a precursor to LDS Hospital, which still exists today. And so they're doing a lot of different stuff. And I think, you know, there's two ways to think about this. One is that this is not atypical for various religious groups in America in the period. The late 19th and early 20th century was the golden age in Christianity of what's called the institutional church, right? When churches begin really sponsoring many, many of these sorts of efforts, largely in response to urbanization and to the growing city and the perception that the city is a problem with its poverty, with its anonymity, and we need to solve it by organizing society, right? So the church in this way, I think, and quite distinct from these earlier efforts in economic communalism and polygamy, was really mirroring what other groups were doing instead of standing distinct and apart from it.
Mirroring the other groups, and yet still doing it themselves rather than joining with any other groups, right? So there's still an element of, well, yeah, we might do the same thing the Presbyterians, but we're going to do it the Mormon way kind of thing.
Yes.
Right?
Precisely. Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
Okay, and then your second point, sorry.
Oh, sure. Yeah, my second point is this. This is, I think, actually a somewhat important fact for these sorts of conversations, but it's not one that's widely discussed. In 1908, the president of the church, Joseph F. Smith, decides that for men in the church, men will be taught about religious things and about doctrine in priesthood quorums. This meant then that the Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association was not supposed to teach about religious and sacred subjects. And they begin then organizing in the sort of secular world, right, and doing things that we would today consider secular, like basketball, like, for instance, the Boy Scouts. They become very involved with the Boy Scouts around this time as well. And the Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association follows suit. So there is, right, still, I think, this, as you say, this real sense of identity, this notion that Mormonism extends into every aspect of one's life, and the church will help to organize every aspect of one's life. Now, this is done in ways that other Americans find acceptable, because other Americans are doing very similar things, right? But it still forms this very kind of robust sense of a vigorous Mormon community that lasts through the mid-20th century.
So, Matt, why did some of those things go away? I mean, why no more basketball tournaments, church-wide basketball tournaments, the music festivals, the road shows, all those things? Why are those no longer?
Well, I don't know that there's not really, I think, a single reason here, because these things kind of fade over time. So there's a multiple set of factors that I think we want to think about. But a couple reasons, I think, in general, that we can look at. The first is I want to point again to that Joseph F. Smith decision about what the youth should be doing, and the distinction he makes between sacred and secular. Right, he says the sacred is the responsibility of priesthood quorums. The secular is what the youth groups can be doing. By the 1960s and 1970s, there is this perception that the church should be more focused on the sacred. I'm using that same kind of distinction. And this is the impetus behind the correlation program. In the 1960s, the church is getting into too much extraneous and too secular things. Now, we can trace, I think, the impulse behind that back to the 1930s. In the 1930s and 1940s, while he is really the major administrative figure behind the church welfare program, J. Reuben Clark, a member of the first presidency, tells the Relief Society that he thinks they should be doing less secular things. He says it is not proper for the Relief Society to get involved in many of the things that they were doing at that point, including political lobbying for legislation and government agencies that would help child health services, that they were operating a lot of these sorts of social work kinds of things. Clark thinks that that is inappropriate. And he tells them, you need to refocus on your sacred calling as wives and mothers, right? So he's seeing this distinction between the sacred and the secular and saying the church should focus on the sacred, beginning with the Relief Society.
Do we know whether finances had anything to do with it? Was the church just overextended? I'm just wondering if they...
Oh, I'm getting there.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I'm getting there. Now, later on, of course, Harold B. Lee is a mentee of Clark, and Lee brings the same sort of attitude to the church in the 1960s and 70s, right? He says we need to refocus on the priesthood. We need to refocus on the sacred, and thus the various curricula that begin to be put out under the aegis of Clark's Correlation Committee really strip away a lot of these earlier activities about literature and so on and so forth. Gardening, which is something that these groups used to do as well, this stuff begins to vanish from church curriculum. Now, that's...
Relief Society was doing out of the great books, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In the early 20th century, right? They were studying literature in most study lessons, right?
Right.
So this sense of what the church should be focused on the sacred really drives this. I think then there are, as Dave, you just brought up, these kind of administrative and organizational and financial reasons as well. The church stops doing sports tournaments in 1971. They also, in the same decade, stop holding church-wide youth gatherings, which did exist in the early 20th century. They do this because by that point it is becoming just impracticable for the church to gather all of these people together in Salt Lake City. It is hard on the organizational administration, but also upon people, armor units of the church that are on the East Coast, in foreign countries, to gather, right? So as the church is growing and becoming less and less and less a kind of organization on the Wasatch Front, in which it was easy for, you know, a church-wide basketball tournament to exist if the furthest you have to drive is up into Idaho and down into Arizona, that is becoming impossible by the 1970s. So the growth of this national and increasingly international church just puts too much of an administrative strain on these earlier institutions, and thus they fold up shop.
So the church is just too big to continue to do those kinds of things, in essence, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's two ways of thinking about size, right? In the one sense, it's just too big, and so these organizations are just too unwieldy. But to make another point related to that, by the time you have large-scale church presence in, say, Mexico or Britain or France, you know, these people aren't playing basketball in the 1970s. They are not interested in this kind of old tradition of Western road shows that grew out of the culture of the American West, right? So the church is not only large, the church is increasingly encompassing multiple cultures. And the sort of cultural institutional building that was very American, that the church had embraced, you know, 50 or 100 years prior, no longer fit.
Mormonland will be right back.
Former 60 Minutes producer Mary Mapes will speak at Weber State University in Ogden on Monday, March 30th. Tickets are $5 for students and $12 to $25 for the general public. Tickets available at weberstatetickets.com.
So, also something happened in 1980, which was known as the Consolidated Meeting Schedule, where before 1980, for example, primary or the Organization for Children met on a day of the week, not Sunday. And so for those groups to reflect Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, as you say, kind of secular activities, made some sense, but then now the church moves them all to Sunday, and that has to have its impact, again, to be more sacred, less secular, and nothing, well, I think the Elders Church has tried things, midweek things like Young Men, Young Women, or Achievement Days, but none of them have really matched the earlier activities and emphasis, right?
Yeah, certainly. Well, and I think, you know, the three-hour block
reflects
a couple of the things that we've been talking about, right? One being this reorientation toward the sacred and reorientation away from things deemed secular, which makes it possible to move these meetings to Sunday, right? And say these are Sabbath things. They are going to reflect what we think the Sabbath should be about. But also, I think the three-hour block derives in part from, again, this growing church. And increasingly, there are wards in which people live half hour, 45 minutes, an hour away from a ward building. Right? The days in which most members of the church could walk to a chapel are gone by the 1980s.
Yeah.
And so it becomes, in some sense, a logistical necessity, right? And I've seen some documents surrounding the three-hour block in which, you know, church leaders are reflecting, or they're expressing concern about oil prices and the price of gas.
Yeah, because that was the gas crisis.
70s, yeah.
Another aspect, and I like how you compared it to Catholicism, because that was also sort of falling apart in the 70s and 80s in terms of forming a particular Catholic identity. And these activities, while considered secular, did help create a uniquely Mormon identity. The groups had names like Beehives or the Boys Trail Builders, things like that, that helped create these young people to think of themselves as having a uniquely Mormon identity. Those start to go away. And so what could be done to, what have they tried to do between the 80s and now to help young people have and there were pageants. Those were not uniquely ward things. Those were, you know, drew from a larger group, but uniquely sort of unusual, wacky, if you will, aspects of being a Mormon youth that slowly are sort of going away.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I two thoughts about this. The first is, you know, I like your invocation of Catholicism there, because in a lot of ways, as I've been thinking about what's been happening inside the church over the past 30 or 40 years, I keep coming back to early modern Roman Catholicism and this question that Catholics were dealing with in the 16th century, in the 17th century, the 18th century, which is, you know, as the church begins expanding to indigenous peoples in the Americas, into Africa, into the Far East, what is essentially Catholic? And how much of this of culture, right, of this sort of European culture, this European Catholic culture, which we might compare to the sort of 19th century Western American culture, how much of that do we want to preserve? How much of it can we preserve? What is the balance between maintaining this identity and expanding all over the world and becoming a worldwide institution? And Roman Catholics, eventually, there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of fits and starts and problems like the rights controversy and the abolishment of the Jesuits in the 18th century for a little while, all this sort of stuff. But gradually, the Roman Catholics settle on, okay, we're going to allow there to be multiple Roman Catholicisms in the world. There will be a distinctly Mexican Roman Catholicism, a distinctly Italian Roman Catholicism, a Polish Roman Catholicism, and they're going to look very different. But they'll be joined by common allegiance to the Pope, common allegiance to the Mass, right? And I think this church, the Church of Christ Latter-day Saints, is going through some of these same wrestles at the moment. There were a lot of people in Roman Catholicism in the 17th and 18th centuries who did not want to sacrifice European traditions and European culture.
And Latin.
And were willing,
right.
Yeah, right, the Latin Mass, right? And were willing to sac, you know, and were willing to give up a certain amount of numbers of size in order to preserve that. But ultimately, right, I think the church landed on the opposite side, and I think these are the kinds of implicit conversations I think that are happening. For instance, around the emergence of a new hymn book, right, about what sort of clothes should be worn in worship services, about church architecture, about all sorts of things. How, you know, what does it mean to be a Mormon, and how do we define that term? Even if we're going to say Latter-day Saint instead of Mormon.
Exactly. So Matt, let's fast forward to more current a little bit. What's going on? Do you see the elimination of scouts, which is a big move, actually, especially in the American mm-hmm. church, and dramatically, the dramatic change to the Young Men, Young Women programs is a move away from group to individual. I mean, the church seems to be stressing individual, although they're certainly saying groups can get together and do things still, like camps and other things.
Sure.
But
mm-hmm.
but even the Young Women theme now says we instead of I, those kinds of things.
No, it says
things.
I instead
yeah,
of
I
we.
I instead of we, yes. Right. Right. The other way around.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, I think what is happening here is a growing sense that the church that we've been discussing in some ways, this church that's, you know, in a community that is densely Mormon, centered along the Wasatch Front, and really characterized by a large sense of identification with the people who live around you, is or at least is no longer, I think, the dominant expression of Mormonism in the world. And that is because, right, growth in the United States is flat. Growth outside the United States is much, much higher. Now, retention outside the United States is much lower than inside the United States. And I think that is a problem that a lot of these reforms are geared to solving. How to increase retention in smaller church units, in more isolated church units, in branches instead of wards, in cultures that are not American. And the kind of flexibility and really, I think, the implicit acknowledgement in a lot of these changes that local units will be building a sort of worship practice that works for them. That's what's behind a lot of these. And it does mean, I think, that we'll see a more diverse and a more kaleidoscopic, a more kind of patchwork quilt sort of Mormonism in the future.
So Is it all the play of, you know, studies showing how young people are sort of abandoning organized religion, I guess, is a shorthand way of saying it, that these individual paths might be more attractive?
Well, and I think, you know, that's an ancillary benefit, perhaps. I mean, that's true primarily in the West, right, in the United States and in Europe, those studies. And I think there is some truth to that because, of course, right, those patterns are beginning to affect the church. You know, the church has historically been better at retention than many Protestant religions are, but these patterns are catching up. So I think, yeah, that is on the mind of church leaders as well.
What do you think about the term home-based, church-supported, which seems to be repeated constantly over and over by church leaders? Do you think, again, not that it's black and white here, but is this a move away from the group? What it meant, not just in the Wasatch Front, what it meant to be a Latter-day Saint on the East Coast, for example, was to belong to a group. But home-based, church-supported seems to move the needle to the nuclear family.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that. Although, you know, the thing that occurs to me with that phrase is the Protestant house church movement, which emerged in the 1970s and 1980s and tried to refocus Protestant worship and Protestant dynamics away from church buildings and into houses. Now, this meant largely kind of family-oriented, but not simply family, right? That families would invite other families over, and you'd build kind of these small, you know, what we might have seen in Mormonism in the 1970s and 1980s, which was the proliferation of study groups, right? And I wonder, right, if that might be the ancillary, or I'm sorry, that might be the result of this.
Except for the difference is, the difference was those Protestant house churches. Mormonism has, at the same time it might be talking about the home, it's also got the Pope, the Mormon Pope, the president of the church, you know what I mean? That's difference, which is, so on the one hand, there was the analog to Catholicism. Now you're saying, oh, but this house home-based thing is Protestant. But Mormonism will never be Protestant as long as there's the president and the sort of ethic of really follow the prophet and the leaders, the hierarchy. That's just something so different than Protestantism.
It is. Yeah, it is. But you know, how is that manifest in practical terms of worship and study and all of that? It may mean that these groups will read conference talks, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Group, right?
Yeah.
Conference talks are all the rage these days.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But these groups still might exist. Right, and you did actually. I mean, if we bring up Catholicism again, you did see these appearing in the Americas in 17th, 18th century Roman Catholicism. They were called confraternities, and they were house-based with no clergy, kind of private, to use, you know, a term we would use today, private Catholic study groups that proliferated as the institutional church was weak in Latin America, which it was for many of those years. So, you know, in some ways, I think this is all kind of, the undoing of parts of correlation, right? Of this real kind of centralization movement of the 60s and 70s towards an increasing decentralization movement. And that means, in some ways, right, the loss of the kind of vigorous centralized identity that correlation provided, and the growth of, I think, maybe more diverse identities in the future.
So speaking of the future, where do you see this going? Because it does seem that there's some, as I just mentioned a minute ago, some tension between allowing a lot of choice and individuality and at the same time elevating the role of church leaders in repeating their conference talks and speaking so highly of them all the time. How do those two things, I understand how they might have worked in the 19th century and even the 20th century when everything was being dictated by the correlation movement, but how do you How do you link those things in a home-centered church?
Oh, wow. That is,
go yeah, for it, Matt.
I mean, I see tension. Yeah, I mean, I don't see a natural development.
I don't see natural tension, right? I think, for instance, under the correlation movement, very thick handbooks for family home evening were produced.
Right.
And people used them and took them home and did it in their homes, you know? And I do think what we are seeing somewhat is the centralized leadership of the church consciously making the effort to say, less things need to be dictated from Salt Lake City. We've seen that in some music reforms, I think, recently. I think the hymn book reflects this, and I think we may see more of that in the future. I mean, certainly, right, the Come Follow Me manuals reflect kind of less long, detailed lessons that you're supposed to go through point by point and encourage more speculation and discussion. Right, so I think if the central leadership is saying that, people will follow.
Do you see that starting to happen? I mean, it seems like sometimes observers say, you know, local church leaders are hesitant to step out of, you know, on their own a little bit. You know, they've been trained and schooled to take direction.
Yes, exactly. There is good reason for that.
Yeah, because we've had a long history of the past 50 years, right, of big handbooks from Salt Lake City,
right,
and, you know, describing everything. But I think, you know, insofar as those handbooks get slimmer and slimmer, and insofar as those lesson manuals get thinner and thinner, and insofar as those manuals encourage more discussion and don't provide point by point what you're supposed to go through. Yeah, I think you will see the emergence of a kind of revitalized local community.
So one other little side question, maybe central, the role of the temple. You know, at the same time as the church is going with the home-based church-supported slogan, it's highly repeating, urging, pressuring people to go to temples, and there's temple building everywhere. And the temple is an interesting mix of individual and collective experience.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all happening. So maybe the emphasis on weekly worship might be declining at the same time as this whole temple building thing happening. How do you see those working together?
Yeah, you know, I think the proliferation of temples is interesting here, right? And as you say, in some ways, the temple is a bit of a blank space in Mormon public discourse. It is celebrated on the outside, but not really discussed on the inside. And so, as you say, I think in many ways a temple can be understood as something that facilitates highly kind of personal and interior experience, because there's simply not a lot of official rhetoric about how you are supposed to interpret the endowment ceremony, for instance. Yeah, so I think the proliferation of temples, I think, is maybe an under-discussed aspect of modern Mormon piety, because it has meant that the temple has, I think, become a much more central part of Mormon life than it was 100 years ago when temples were not as accessible as they are now. And when I'm thinking of Reed Smoot, right, who when he was elected to the Senate, reported that he had gone to the temple for his endowment and to be sealed and never again, and he was an apostle.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that bears future examination, I think.
Mm-hmm. Matt, let me ask you to put on your little prognosticator hat now, or at least what do you see in the changes that the church is undertaking? Some have already started, some are still going to be happening. What does the church stand on this communal front tend to potentially gain or lose in this evolution?
Well, you know, I think, and some of it depends, I think, on the extent to which the leadership of the church is willing to commit to decentralization. If that does happen, then I think it's quite possible that you will see kind of a flourishing of Mormonism in the global South, but a Mormonism that looks rather different than the Mormonism of the Wasatch Front. And that would mean, I think, the church may become successful. It may become a global religion, right? One that is rooted all around the world. On the other hand, right, if that doesn't happen, if the church does continue to cling to many of those aspects, which right now mean that it's not flourishing in the global South, things like, you know, Western standards of dress and worship, the notion of reverence, then I think it may remain what it is, which is to say, a kind of small, not really growing, largely American religion with roots all over the world that are still dependent upon Salt Lake City.
Yeah. You know, members sort of now pride themselves on going to a meeting anywhere in the world from where they usually go at home and feeling perfectly at home in mm-hmm. another country. They may not understand the language, but they'll still know they're in a Mormon church and in a Mormon meeting. You don't see that changing, do you? Or do you think that could change?
Perhaps. Yeah. Well, you know, I think, again, to invoke another a parallel, right? The Catholic Mass is recognizably the Mass, but a Mass in Mexico looks a lot different from a Mass in Poland. You know, and I think, you know, that there's some middle ground between, you know, perfect replication and not at all. And I think it's that kind of sweet spot that if the church really wants to thrive, that it needs to find.
Which may not be easy, but yes.
No, it's never easy. It's just a Catholic 300 years.
That's right. Matthew Bowman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we should note that it's Matt's birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you for that, too.
And thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And our producer, Sarah Weber. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next week on Mormonland.